Chapter 160. Another secret, my dear. I have added to my collection of birds. Really, Miss Flight? Said I, knowing how it pleased her to have her confidence received with an appearance of interest. She nodded several times, and her face became overcast and gloomy. Two more. I call them the warts in Jarndyce. They are caged up with all the others. With hope, joy, youth, peace, rest, life, dust, ashes, waste, want, ruin, despair, madness, death, cunning, folly, words, wicks, rags, sheepskin, plunder, precedent, jargon, gammon, and spinach. The poor soul kissed me with the most troubled look I had ever seen in her, and went her way. Her manner of running over the names of her birds, as if she were afraid of hearing them even from her own lips, quite chilled me. This was not a cheering preparation for my visit, and I could have dispensed with the company of Mr. Vholes, when Richard, who arrived within a minute or two after me, brought him to share our dinner. Although it was a very plain one, Ada and Richard were for some minutes both out of the room together helping to get ready what we were to eat and drink. Mr. Vholes took that opportunity of holding a little conversation in a low voice with me. He came to the window where I was sitting, and began upon Simmons Inn. A dull place, Miss Summerson, for a life that is not an official one, said Mr. Vholes, smearing the glass with his black glove to make it clearer for me. There is not much to see here, said one. Nor to hear, miss, returned Mr. Vholes. A little music does occasionally stray in, but we are not musical in the law and soon eject it. I hope Mr. Jarndyce is as well as his friends could wish him. I thanked Mr. Vholes and said he was quite well. I have not the pleasure to be admitted among the number of his friends myself, said Mr. Vholes, and I am aware that the gentlemen of our profession are sometimes regarded in such quarters with an unfavorable eye. Our plain course, however, under good report and evil report, and all kinds of prejudice, we are the victims of prejudice, is to have everything openly carried on. How do you find Mr. C. looking, Miss Summerson? He looks very ill. Dreadfully anxious. Just so, said Mr. Vholes. He stood behind me with his long black figure reaching nearly to the ceiling of those low rooms, feeling the pimples on his face, as if they were ornaments and speaking inwardly and evenly, as though there were not a human passion or emotion in his nature. Mr. Woodcourt is in attendance upon Mr. C., I believe? He resumed. Mr. Woodcourt is his disinterested friend, I answered. But I mean in professional attendance, medical attendance. That can do little for an unhappy mind, said one. Just so, said Mr. Vholes. So slow, so eager, so bloodless and gaunt, I felt as if Richard were wasting away beneath the eyes of this adviser, and there were something of the vampire in him. Miss Summerson, said Mr. Vholes, very slowly rubbing his gloved hands, as if, to his cold sense of touch, they were much the same in black kid, or out of it, this was an ill-advised marriage of Mr. C.S. I begged he would excuse me from discussing it. They had been engaged, when they were both very young, I told him a little indignantly, and when the prospect before them was much fairer and brighter. When Richard had not yielded himself to the unhappy influence which now darkened his life. Just so, assented Mr. Vholes again. Still, with a view to everything being openly carried on, I will, with your permission, Miss Summerson, observe to you that I consider this a very ill-advised marriage indeed. I owe the opinion not only to Mr. C.S. connections, against whom I should naturally wish to protect myself, but also to my own reputation dear to myself as a professional man aiming to keep respectable. Dear to my three girls at home, for whom I am striving to realize some little independence. Dear, I will even say, to my aged father, whom it is my privilege to support. It would become a very different marriage, a much happier and better marriage, another marriage altogether, Mr. Vholes, said I, if Richard were persuaded to turn his back on the fatal pursuit in which you are engaged with him. Mr. Voles, with a noiseless cough or rather gasp into one of his black gloves, inclined his head, as if he did not wholly dispute even that. Miss Summerson, he said, it may be so, and I freely admit that the young lady who has taken Mr. C.'s name upon herself in so ill-advised a manner you will, I am sure, not quarrel with me for throwing out that remark again, as a duty I owe to Mr. C.'s connections as a highly genteel young lady. Business has prevented me from mixing much with general society in any but a professional character. Still, I trust I am competent to perceive that she is a highly genteel young lady. As to beauty, I am not a judge of that myself, and I never did give much attention to it from a boy, but I dare say the young lady is equally eligible in that point of view. She is considered, so I have heard, among the clerks in the inn, and it is a point more in their way than in mine. In reference to Mr. C.S. Purcell of his interests, oh, his interests, Mr. Voles. Pardon me, returned Mr. Voles, going on in exactly the same inward and dispassionate manner. Mr. C. takes certain interests under certain wills disputed in the suit. It is a term we use. In reference to Mr. C.'s pursuit of his interests, I mentioned to you, Miss Summerson, the first time I had the pleasure of seeing you, in my desire that everything should be openly carried on, I used those words, for I happened afterwards to note them in my diary, which is producible at any time. I mentioned to you that Mr. C. had laid down the principle of watching his own interests, and that when a client of mine laid down a principle which was not of an immoral, that is to say, unlawful, nature, it devolved upon me to carry it out. I have carried it out. I do carry it out. But I will not smooth things over to any connection of Mr. C.S. on any account. As open as I was to Mr. Jarndyce, I am to you. I regard it in the light of a professional duty to be so, though it can be charged to no one. I openly say, unpalatable as it may be, that I consider Mr. C.'s affairs in a very bad way, that I consider Mr. C. himself in a very bad way, and that I regard this as an exceedingly ill-advised marriage. Am I here, sir? Yes, I thank you. I am here, Mr. C., and enjoying the pleasure of some agreeable conversation with Miss Summerson, for which I have to thank you very much, sir. He broke off thus in answer to Richard, who addressed him as he came into the room. By this time I too well understood Mr. Vole's scrupulous way of saving himself, and his respectability not to feel that our worst fears did but keep pace with his client's progress. We sat down to dinner, and I had an opportunity of observing Richard anxiously. I was not disturbed by Mr. Voles, who took off his gloves to dine, though he sat opposite to me at the small table, for I doubt if, looking up at all, he once removed his eyes from his host's face. I found Richard thin and languid, slovenly in his dress, abstracted in his manner, forcing his spirits now and then, and at other intervals relapsing into a dull thoughtfulness. About his large bright eyes, that used to be so merry, there was a wanness and a restlessness that changed them altogether. One cannot use the expression that he looked old. There is a ruin of youth which is not like age, and into such a ruin Richard's youth and youthful beauty had all fallen away. He ate little, and seemed indifferent what it was, showed himself to be much more impatient than he used to be, and was quick even with Ada. I thought at first that his old light-hearted manner was all gone, but it shone out of him sometimes as I had occasionally known little momentary glimpses of my own old face to look out upon me from the glass. His laugh had not quite left him either, but it was like the echo of a joyful sound, and that is always sorrowful. Yet he was as glad as ever, in his old affectionate way, to have me there, and we talked of the old times pleasantly. These did not appear to be interesting to Mr. Voles, though he occasionally made a gasp which I believe was his smile. He rose shortly after dinner and said that with the permission of the ladies he would retire to his office. Always devoted to business, Voles, cried Richard. Yes, Mr. C. He returned, The interests of clients are never to be neglected, sir. They are paramount in the thoughts of a professional man like myself, who wishes to preserve a good name among his fellow practitioners and society at large. My denying myself the pleasure of the present agreeable conversation may not be wholly irrespective of your own interests, Mr. C. Richard expressed himself quite sure of that and lighted Mr. Vholes out. On his return he told us, more than once, that Vholes was a good fellow, a safe fellow, a man who did what he pretended to do, a very good fellow indeed. He was so defiant about it, that it struck me, he had begun to doubt Mr. Vholes. Then he threw himself on the sofa, tired out, and Ada and I put things to rights, for they had no other servant than the woman who attended to the chambers. My dear girl had a cottage piano there, and quietly sat down to sing some of Richard's favorites, the lamp being first removed into the next room, as he complained of its hurting his eyes. I sat between them, at my dear girl's side, and felt very melancholy listening to her sweet voice. I think Richard did too. I think he darkened the room for that reason. She had been singing some time, rising between whiles to bend over him, and speak to him, when Mr. Woodcourt came in. Then he sat down by Richard and half playfully, half earnestly, quite naturally and easily, found out how he felt, and where he had been all day. Presently he proposed to accompany him in a short walk on one of the bridges, as it was a moonlight airy night, and Richard readily consenting, they went out together. They left my dear girl still sitting at the piano and me still sitting beside her. When they were gone out, I drew my arm round her waist. She put her left hand in mine. I was sitting on that side, but kept her right upon the keys, going over and over them without striking any note. "Esther, my dearest," she said, breaking silence, "Richard is never so well, and I am never so easy about him as when he is with Alan Woodcourt. We have to thank you for that." I pointed out to my darling how this could scarcely be, because Mr. Woodcourt had come to her cousin John's house, and had known us all there, and because he had always liked Richard, and Richard had always liked him, and so forth. "All true," said Ada, "but that he is such a devoted friend to us, we owe to you." I thought it best to let my dear girl have her way, and to say no more about it. So I said as much. I said it lightly, because I felt her trembling. "Esther, my dearest, I want to be a good wife, a very, very good wife indeed. You shall teach me." "I teach." I said no more, for I noticed the hand that was fluttering over the keys, and I knew that it was not I who ought to speak, that it was she who had something to say to me. When I married Richard, I was not insensible to what was before him. I had been perfectly happy for a long time with you, and I had never known any trouble or anxiety, so loved and cared for, but I understood the danger he was in, dear Esther. I know, my darling. When we were married I had some little hope that I might be able to convince him of his mistake, that he might come to regard it in a new way as my husband, and not pursue it all the more desperately for my sake as he does. But if I had not had that hope, I would have married him just the same, Esther. Just the same. In the momentary firmness of the hand, that was never still a firmness inspired by the utterance of these last words, and dying away with them, I saw the confirmation of her earnest tones. "You are not to think, my dearest Esther, that I fail to see what you see, and fear what you fear. No one can understand him better than I do. The greatest wisdom that ever lived in the world could scarcely know Richard better than my love does." She spoke so modestly and softly, and her trembling hand expressed such agitation as it moved to and fro upon the silent notes. "My dear, dear girl. I see him at his worst every day. I watch him in his sleep. I know every change of his face. But when I married Richard I was quite determined, Esther, if heaven would help me, never to show him that I grieved for what he did, and so to make him more unhappy. I want him, when he comes home, to find no trouble in my face. I want him, when he looks at me, to see what he loved in me. I married him to do this, and this supports me. I felt her trembling more. I waited for what was yet to come, and I now thought I began to know what it was. And something else supports me, Esther. She stopped a minute. Stopped speaking only. Her hand was still in motion. I look forward a little while, and I don't know what great aid may come to me. When Richard turns his eyes upon me then, there may be something lying on my breast more eloquent than I have been, with greater power than mine to show him his true course, and win him back. Her hand stopped now. She clasped me in her arms, and I clasped her in mine. If that little creature should fail to, Esther, I still look forward. I look forward a long while, through years and years, and think that then, when I am growing old, or when I am dead perhaps, a beautiful woman, his daughter, happily married, may be proud of him, and a blessing to him. Or that a generous, brave man, as handsome as he used to be, as hopeful, and far more happy, may walk in the sunshine with him, honoring his gray head and saying to himself, I thank God this is my father. Ruined by a fatal inheritance, and restored through me. Apostrophe, oh, my sweet girl, what a heart was that which beat so fast against me. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.